chatting with a radio legend. I'm Jerry Barmash, and this is Here Now the News. John Montone had a distinct style as the longtime 1010 Winds Morning Drive reporter. He would put a unique spin on his daily stories. John's specialty was finding people from all walks of life for instant reaction to the story of the day, a term called MOS in the business. John recently retired from Winds after four decades, and I'm excited to chat with him about that amazing career that ranges from his signature lighter moments to that devastating day in September 20 years ago. We also discuss his future plans, why this was the time to exit, and what he'll miss most.
John Montone, I am thrilled to speak to you today. I know it meant you had to retire for me to have you on my podcast, but thanks for doing this. Thanks for connecting with me. And you are just absolutely synonymous with 1010 Winds. How long were you there? 40 years, just about?
Not quite. I started working as the North Jersey reporter, the stringer, we used to call it, back near the end of 1982. So just short of 40 years in various part-time and full-time positions.
You certainly were a master, I guess, of the MOS. For people that don't know MOS, that is man on the street. Of course, it could be a woman as well. What was that technique? Because you're doing that in morning drive, which is not always the easiest time to probably get people, I would think.
Yeah, I think it developed over time. One of the first big stories I covered for 1010 Winds was a railroad strike in New Jersey. New Jersey Transit was in its infancy, and the union conductors and the train operators walked out. They had been working for the old Erie Lackawanna, and they set up, NJT did, a service called Kiss and Ride. It was shuttle buses, and it was really after, you know, you said, well, there are shuttle buses and, you know, one, the husband or the wife gets dropped off and the other one leaves and goes back home. There wasn't much to say. So there was this young couple. They were very friendly. And I said to her, as she was about to drop off her husband on the Kiss and Ride, could you give him a kiss? I had the microphone there and she kissed him. And I said, you know, maybe, just a little louder there. And she did. And I did the story like that. And, you know, we didn't have a cell phone, so I didn't hear back from the station right away. Next time I called in to go live, old line editor said, what are you doing? You know, this isn't a clown show. This is a news station. No more with the smooches. And I said, I'm sorry. And then she stopped and said, oh, wait a minute. The news manager really liked it. So I said, okay. And it gave me confidence to kind of engage people. And rather than what was the standard, you know, three-part wrap around then, you know, you wrote something, the person you interviewed said something, and then you wrote some more and said goodbye. I start having conversations with people and making that a big portion of the story.
You were almost in some way, and maybe you'll disagree, almost broke the format for Winds. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely. I think we started to use MOS a lot more. It used to be for, you know, pretty big stories, you know, what the vox populi, what do the people think about this? We changed it a bit, I think, because they sort of liked what I was doing, that we would ask people, you know, didn't have to be the biggest story, could be something a little silly, a little annoying. And, you know, the idea was to give voice to our listening audience. I mean, it's really, I mean, there are some talk stations in New York, but they're not always really local talk stations. And, you know, we gave voice to the people who listen, the hard hats and the people on the subway platforms and the coffee cart guys and the cabbies, of course. Sure. We let them, you know, what do you think about this? And, so that was something that became a big part of the format.
And doing that in the morning, as renowned as you became for that, what was it ever difficult to get people in the morning drive? It's before dawn. Is that ever been a problem?
So there was a time when it became much less difficult. It's always difficult to approach people, down in the subway or at a train station, in Times Square at 4:15 in the morning, because they don't expect it. They may think, the microphone is a gun or something. But then we became so popular and people knew us that it became much, much easier. And then toward the end, with everybody, plugged in with the earbuds and everything and walking by and not paying attention, it became a bit harder again. But having this microphone with the big yellow call letters, 1010 wins, a lot of people knew who you were,
So even if they didn't know you by face, being on radio, they would know the voice. But even if they didn't know the voice
immediately, so many people would call, and I was the guy in the morning. So they would say, "John, hey, how you doing, man? I heard you this, and it became like a very big, large community for me. And if I was out in a neighborhood in Park Slope or something, or I was somewhere in the Bronx, people might hear a report and then come looking for me. And that made it even a little easier.
You must have loved that, where you were getting that instant recognition from people.
Yeah, because, when you're on the radio and you're doing your story and, I'm doing the interviews and I'm editing the audio and I'm writing the story and then I'm delivering it live, you don't get any feedback. I mean, maybe I know Bridget Quinn, who I worked with for the last several years, she would give a little, like once in a while when I did a story. But for the most part, you don't know how the audience is reacting. You have to trust your instinct that you've done it well.
Did you get feedback every once in a while from bosses?
Sure. I think I had a couple of bosses along the way who I think scratched their heads and said, "Is this news?" What one fellow came over and the first day there was a guy who was shooting a BB gun on Fifth Avenue in store windows at mannequins, and I called him some crackpot with a BB gun. And the new manager went to the editor and said, "Shouldn't our reporter call this fellow the alleged perpetrator?" And my editor said, "Well, why don't you tell him?" So he called me in his office and sat me down and said, "From now on, let's call people who haven't been, convicted of the alleged perpetrator." And I told him, not even older Irish cops in Queens talk like that anymore. This is a crackpot with a BB gun.
Right.
So he didn't get me. But then, the guy who's been my boss for the last 20 years and has become one of my best friends, Ben Meverack, not only did he get me, but he pushed me. He pushed me to do more. Take chances. Trust your instinct. And that's what you ask from a good manager.
That's great. And that has to make you feel more at ease that you can, like you said, take these chances to push yourself. Push those limits.
And he would get occasional emails that, "Your reporter said, and he shouldn't be saying that. I had a child in the car and your report." But he would deflect it. And he would, every once in a while say, maybe. But for the most part, he encouraged me, and we sat down and we talked about, stories that we wanted to do. I remember when Trump was about to take office, it's divisive and it's New York City, where he certainly wasn't all that popular. And Ben said, "Do this, have people say, 'Dear Donald,' and then blah, 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 whatever they want to say." And I start to, and at first I said, "No, but start it with 'Dear Donald.'" And it would be, "Dear Donald, don't be a blah, 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 blah. Dear Donald, could you please rebuild that, you know, and it worked out great. It was just great sound, and we were able to collaborate like that.
So you were able to balance it that way, I guess.
Yeah, and I had a great Jim Maloney, our editor. He would find stories, you know, that he felt were a good fit for me. You know, another editor may have said, well, I've got to put my reporter on the list. Now, in later years, I ended up working with Glenn Schuck. So there's two of us on the street. But there was a time I was the only guy on the street. And Maloney at times would say, you know, you should be on, I guess, this lead story, this fire. He goes, but here's another story. People are going to be talking. We used to call them the water cooler stories. I don't know if it's water cooler anymore, but they were the stories people would mention on Facebook or Twitter or something.
I was wondering about that. So you had your team there at the station that would help you decide what is a John Montone story.
Yeah. For the most part, I mean, I didn't pick the stories I was going to cover. Now, there might be something I might see in the papers or on, you know, Twitter or somewhere, you know, a few days before. And I'd say, hey, Jim, this might be a good one for Friday morning. And, you know, but for the most part, you know, that my job wasn't to choose the stories.
Did you ever question the choices? Were there ones that just didn't fit for you? Oh, yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, now with Jim and I, it would be, generally speaking, if I went to some sort of disaster, some fire or something, and I would get there, and if I'd say, you know, Jim, this is a photo, this is a TV, you know, shoot from the, it's just not a radio. We're not gonna get anybody here talking to us or anything, and so we would, and then, you know, occasionally there were replacement editors who might come up. I remember one guy. We had done, remember the Pizza Rat, became the big social media viral, you know, thing, the rat pulling the pizza down. That was funny. And it was good. And I went down into the subway and talked to people. So for some reason, a video of a student who was drunk up at UConn and was complaining that they wouldn't serve him mac and cheese late on a Saturday night in the cafeteria, somehow it went viral. And this replacement editor said, you know, you got to go out and ask people what they think of this video. And I looked at it and I said, well, I'm not going to be doing that because who cares? He's a kid on a Saturday night, a college kid who got a little drunk and got a little fresh with the cafeteria help. And they pulled him. I said, that's not a great story. You know, but immediately they thought, well, it's viral, so we've got to, you know.
Yeah.
So I did at times.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you wind up doing that one?
No.
You did hold your ground on that.
Yeah. There were times I would, you know, just say this is not the story, you know, that we want to be doing. But it was usually with someone who didn't have a lot of experience, and I wasn't nasty about it. But I would say, you know, you got to think about this right now. I'm your main reporter. This is going to be our lead story about some student who was pissed off because he didn't get his mac and cheese. I said, that's not news. A rat dragging pizza down. I get that, you know.
Right. And this
same editor, by the way, who continued to fill in right before I retired, came up with a great story one morning. It was about a pet tortoise that escaped in Bay Ridge, and people, the whole neighborhood was looking for the tortoise. And as I'm looking, we didn't have a lot of information. As I'm reading it, it just occurred to me, must be a slow news day. So that became the, you know, we did that. So, and that was good. You know, that was, people got it. I got on Twitter, a slow news day.
Were you aware of how good you were? Were you aware of, you know, how your skills were translating to what you were doing on Wins?
Well, I got the feeling that I was pretty good at it when they hired me to be the morning guy. And again, I was the only morning guy at the time. So it was back in sort of the end of 1992, and there was some pretty good competition for it. And, you know, they hired me. I figured, well, I guess I earned it and they have confidence in me. I never, you know, radio, the words disappear, and that's it. And the next day, you got to do the whole thing all over again. So there were those mornings, well, can I do it? I'd be driving in, you know, coming down the West Side Highway from Jersey, and I'd be thinking about the story. Can I make it, you know, really sing? Can I do it? And, you know, there are times you have self-doubts. I'm a big baseball fan, and I know even good hitters go through slumps, and you're not really just hitting it. I was crazy about, you can't read my handwriting, but I always use the reporter notebooks, even after we got the laptops and stuff. And I'd be, even as like Lee Harris or Bridget Quinn would be throwing the story to me, I'd be editing the thing and underlining things. And, you know, so I wanted it to work coming from me. I wrote for my voice.
What was your style? And by the way, Mike Zirinax, of course, your longtime colleague from sister station, 880. I'm good friends with him. And he asked me, he says, you talk to John, ask him. He goes, that last one was sort of his question. But then he also like the style you had. Was that deliberate? Did you go out of your way to sound the way you did?
No. I think it was just natural. I developed it. I mean, it was you know, it was talking into a microphone the way I would talk normally. I mean, I would give it a little more energy and, you know, certainly punch up some words more than other words, some phrases. But no, it wasn't. I mean, we sell the story. Right. We want to sell the story, especially if we really believe in it. And we are performers in addition to being reporters. But no, I think that was pretty much, you know, who I am.
Do you think we're talking about obviously mornings, and you were there for 30 years, really, in the morning. And that's of course, for radio, that's prime time. That's where, you know, the money is made and the listenership is. And for Wins, that's the big news station. Do you think that the station would actually will drop off, because you were the you were the voice. I mean, you were the person that people were listening for.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the station has so much more to offer. It's so important in the media landscape of New York City. I mean, it's the news watch never stops. I mean, something goes on and you immediately, I believe, think of 10-10 Wins. So I think I was an important part. I think they'll do fine. And the great thing is, you know, now people can listen on their devices.
Right.
They can say, hey, Siri, play 10-10 Wins. Hopefully the audience will continue to grow. I've always said that other than my family, 10-10 Wins is, you know, one of the most important aspects of my life. I want to wake up 20 years from now. I hope I'm still waking up 20 years from now and turn on 10-10 Wins and hear it. And I think I will.
What's a worst experience that you had, either dealing with a reporter, with a person in the street, or something that you covered?
Well, obviously,
other than 9/11, I guess.
I mean, 9/11 was just, you know, you can't even put it in the category.
I wanted to ask you about that, of course, too.
Sure. Our kids were young, so I think it might have been the mid to late 90s. And it was a beautiful spring day, but it was very windy. And we had beepers at the time. And I got a page, and the news picked it up, and I called the newsroom, and it was a tree got blown over in Queens, I think it was in Queens, and it fell on a school bus, and there are kids in it, and some of them might be badly hurt. And I got out there. I mean, I just hopped in the car. It was downtown. It was at City Hall. And I got there, and three, maybe four little girls were killed. Little girls, you know, fourth grade. And I got there as the families were getting there. heartbreaking. You know, when I was a freelancer in the 80s, I saw a lot of bodies, bodies that had gotten shot, bodies that had gotten run over. You don't see that much anymore. They kind of clean it up before they let you near it. But I didn't see these kids, the bodies. But, you know, I went home and it was and like anything else. That night we sat down for dinner and the three kids sat around the table and they were yapping and there was everything in the and I just start crying. I couldn't stop it. It was I had never had that experience before. And my wife said, "You okay?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." I said, I can't. I had to walk away for a while. So I do remember how that had hit me.
More with John Montone is coming up. As we approach the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, John was gracious enough to detail his memories from that unthinkable day.
I was on the Upper East Side. It was the mayoral primary day, and I was covering Mark Green, the public advocate who was the leader in the Democratic field. And he came out of the school where he voted, you know, a big crush of reporters. And he said, you know, today we will make history. Yes, indeed. Not because he became the Democratic nominee, but and then again, I still had the pager on, even though we had car phone then and we had a kind of a flip cell phone. And I got a page that said, call the station. And I called and they said, you know, a small plane has hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Well, you know, I don't care how small a plane they thought it was. That happens. You know, that's a big story. So I raced down the Harlem River, I guess, the FDR, and I was behind quite a few ambulances, police vehicles, and just got in the middle of them. So went right down. And on the way down, our anchor, Lee Harris, was on with one of our account execs, Joan Fleischer, who lived down there. And as you know, she was describing what she saw and she screamed and another plane had hit the South Tower. And, you know, Lee quickly realized, well, this is an attack. This is deliberate. So when I got down, I dropped the 1010 Winds mobile unit, as we call it. It was a Ford Explorer on Broadway. And I ran right down to the towers and people were running away from the towers and I was interviewing them, but neither my cell phone nor my car phone would work. I couldn't make a connection. So up on Broadway, there was a store that I used to frequent quite a bit. I'm a music freak. It was called The Record Explosion. And they knew me and I went in and I told them, you know, I need a landline. They gave it to me and I went on the air with Lee Harris and, you know, just on and on and on about what I had seen, what people had told me. I have pretty good recall, you know, when things are happening because I wasn't, I don't believe I was playing the audio there. It was just a regular phone. And then they had a breakaway. I guess the president, Bush, was going to have some sort of an update. And so I said, all right, I'm going to go back down to the towers. And I went down and I was right between the South Tower and the Century 21 department store. And the doorman there came over and he tapped me on the shoulder. He said, you know, you better watch out because a lot of, you know, shit, he said, is falling. And I looked up and, you know, there was a lot of thick ash and stuff and I could see the fuselage embedded in the building and I thought, geez, how could these guys do this to us? And so I went back up to Broadway as I'm going up to Broadway and I didn't really think of it at the time as part of the story, but just lines of firefighters, young guys were coming down toward the building. There was no, the police had cleared the area out. I had to leave, go back up to Broadway, but they were walking right into it. And I got up to Broadway and I began interviewing people again. And some woman screamed, it's falling, it's coming down. And in my mind's eye, I thought of the tower collapsing, but of course it imploded and it disintegrated, vaporized Yeah. And it was just like this whoosh of dust. And then there was this massive pileup of people just, and we all, everyone tried to get into some of the buildings on Broadway for safety. We didn't know. And I was crushed under people. People were going, coming into the building that I was in from the Nassau Street side. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die under here. My lungs are get crushed. But gradually people start getting up and telling everyone the Nassau Street side, don't go out the other way. And so I got out. And the first thing I realized was I had a microphone and no recorder. We had switched recently from the big old Marantz or Sony, you know, cassette recorders, XLR plugs, to a manager, a news manager who loved the most modern things. And it was a little thing, I think it was called the mini disc recorder. Mm. And it was plugged in with a mini plug. And in the scrum, of course, it got ripped out. And
no.
I lost all of my interviews, all of my audio, you know, and I was one of the first ones there. Like, I was angry for seconds, and then I looked up and that beautiful blue September sky was gone, and it was blackish gray and ash was just falling, and people, adults, mostly men, were walking around with briefcases almost in circles as this ash piled up. And when I finally got to a building with a phone down on Water Street, I remember describing it as what I would have thought nuclear winter looked like. Hmm. And, you know, and I continued to tell the stories for about an hour or two more when, you know, the station, people at the station, when I called in, they were all relieved. They thought maybe I had, you know, met my end. And I told the stories for a while, but then we had other reporters there who had working equipment. And then I was relieved of my duties that day. It was already around noon, I guess.
What a harrowing story. Was there fear?
I didn't have time to be that scared.
Right.
When I was working and interviewing people or on the air from the record shop, I was... fear never entered my mind. When the building fell and I was on the bottom, especially in that hallway, there were three or four people like on top of me, and everybody was, you know, I was thinking, how much longer can I breathe? It was fear. I thought of my family, and I was looking around and the dust was coming in. And I think I remember thinking that this would be a strange way to die, but I didn't give it much thought. And then I was so upset that I had lost the recorder, because this is, you know, you can never get that back. And I was there, and people were telling me the stories of the shadows of the plane and coming out of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel then, and in the bus and seeing it and hearing it and the screams and, you know, how they got out of the building. So I had so much, you know, that even if I didn't use it all that day, I'm sure would have been part of the historical record. That was lost because we had crummy consumer equipment, which, you know, which we shouldn't have had at that time. I mean, you know, I probably from that point on became very involved, along with Lee Harris, in upgrading how we got on the air. We wanted broadband sound on the radio, not sound from a cell phone with the speaker pressed up, the mouthpiece pressed up to the speaker of some little tinny recorder. We wanted good, solid sound, and we kept working at it to the point where we got, I guess, the latest were the digital recorders. And then we actually start going out into the field with mini pads, iPads, and we could do all our editing on those. So, so that was a lesson learned. And then, you know, in the months, weeks and months that followed, so many people who only knew me as a voice on the radio brought me into their homes and shared their stories, their loss. And so that was, you know, obviously the biggest, you know, you can't cover a bigger story than that.
And were you down there more than one day?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was back. I mean, you know, it was the story for such a long time. And, you know, you're constantly going back. And I remember we used to, the death smell, the death dust. It was, and, you know, latest big story, the pandemic, we had masks on, but none of us had masks.
After 9/11, did you consciously change your style because it was such a sad time in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first time that I may have loosened up a bit was covering the Yankees in the World Series in 2001. You know, talking to the, you know, in, you know, with the fans in the stands at Yankee Stadium, and you know, there were some great home games and Jeter and I think Brocious or something, big hits in the ninth inning to come back. And so, yeah, so then it was time, but there was also the mention of the metal detectors, you know, the World Series in the Age of Terror, the tattered flag flying from ground zero and the firefighters being honored, the president throwing out the pitch, you know, so it was, it took a while to really get back, you know, that type of mojo where you could be a little snarky and stuff and, you know, talk to, you know, the cabbies about their gripes. And, you know, it took a while. It stayed with you for a while.
I know in the last several years, you were also doing TV work for sister station WCBS-TV.
Yeah, that wasn't the last few years, but there was a couple of segments that I did for them. Mouth Off to Montone was one of them. And then the latest one that ran the longest was Montone on the Move, where I would do MOS, go out on the street and do that type of thing. It would be cut up. And and we did that for a while.
Was that your idea? Did you want to get like some TV work involved?
No. I mean, not that I didn't. I mean, I was under contract to CBS. And so whether it was, you know, radio, the main thing, and the emerging social media or television, and someone in CBS said, you know, we've got to start using our news radio reporters to do some television. I wasn't the only one. A couple of other guys did some work, too. But yeah, you know, and I was a little self-conscious, as you know, little past middle age, I'd gained a little weight and I hated seeing myself on the screen, but so that actually made me lose weight. But it was pretty much the same thing. I didn't change to try to be a, you know, a TV guy standing, you know, I was still with the microphone, you know.
But I guess it even gave you even more of a presence in New York.
I guess so. Yeah. People would say, "Hey, saw you on TV, saw you on Channel 2. See you on Channel 2." And I still think it was mostly though 10-10 wins. That was where people knew me from.
Right. And again, in Morning Drive. So now that you retired, do you have something on the horizon? Is there something for your future?
What we're still doing, it's John Montone live at 8:05 on the 1010 Wins Facebook page. It's a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. The joke is from Lee Harris, when I would do these getaway stories with people and they'd start leaving instead of Friday for the long vacation week, and they start leaving Thursday, and you'd say, Thursday is the new Friday, and Monday is the new Sunday, and we start doing that. But we do it Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We've been doing it, we used to do it 5 days a week, but we've been doing it now for, I think, 5-6 years. I have a pretty decent following. You know, by the end of the day, I generally have over 1,000 views. Now, we're using a StreamYard technology. So we've done interviews, Zoom type interviews. The people who listen, they write down, you know, their feelings about the topic of the day, the the vaccines or whatever. And, you know, I read them, you know, aloud. And my wife, or Mary, is a retired teacher. I call her the unpaid intern who's producing this. And the joke is that the normal rules that govern the relationship between the boss and the intern no longer apply in this case, because we've been married for 40 years. So we joke, and so we're doing that. I mean, for now, I think we'll do that. Ben and I have talked about maybe some projects down the line, but this was a good time to get out, given that I live at the Jersey Shore and we're entering the summer.
Yeah.
So the relationship between me and the radio station is still there.
Right.
You know, it was just that after being remote for so long, and I would come up occasionally. The last time was to do something for the Yankees home opener, get some sound with the fans the day before. But it was time, as the city just, you know, brims with life again, fortunately. The thought of coming up even 2 days a week, say, to stay in a hotel, and I could never do anything half speed. You know, when I hit the street in the morning, you know, whether it was a snowstorm or just a regular story where I was running up and down the stairs at the subway, because, you know, the escalators never work, you know, and running around and grabbing cabbies and stuff. I'm going to be 68 years old. It's got to be physically demanding. And the thought after sitting here in the bar room here, the Mojo Lounge, after sitting at the bar in the Mojo Lounge for, you know, the better part, actually more than a year, the thought of running around the streets of, you know, the greatest city on the planet, but so big, you know, I can't do this anymore.
What will you miss most about it, though?
I miss everything about it. I mean, I loved the job. I loved interviewing people. I loved editing the tape. I loved writing it, the stories, and then performing, broadcasting the stories. And I loved, I would go into Ben's office at time, and other guys would come in, the morning crew, and I loved talking about the radio and about news. I always joke, you know, this is a little bit out there, but my first news job was as a paper boy. Delivered papers in Cliffside Park, New Jersey, high atop the Palisades. And I had my canvas bag and my bicycle and my 6 transistor radio. I'd be listening to, you know, WABC or the WMCA, the good guys. And I'd look over the Hudson River at the lights of the city. And I'd wonder, you know, because it was early in the morning, it could be dark. Where is this voice coming from? Where is this voice coming from? Then I'd go home and I'd sit down and I'd read the newspaper I had just delivered. So, you know, who knew? There are a lot of things happened in between, but
right.
sort of a dream that worked out, you know?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming on and talking. It's been a treat to speak to you today.
Thank you. You too. Thank you. I appreciate it. I know you love radio like I do. So it's... you know, I always have time, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I was on the station through Shadow doing sports and traffic, mm-hmm. it was to be on the station that you were on, it was like, wow.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I always tell people, and I always say to people, you know, who come up to me and, you know, I heard you, I've listened to you for years, or sometimes they'll quote a story or something. I always say the same, thank you for listening. Because without the listeners, then, you know, what are we just talking to, you know, please ourselves?
Yeah,
they pay the salaries, and, you know, they keep us going. And so I always thank them for listening.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
thanks,
best of retirement.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
The great John Montone joining us on the podcast today. You can leave a comment or question on Twitter @JerryBarmash. Email me at HereNowTheNewsJB, at gmail.com. Thanks for listening to Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Barnash.